Welcome to SCI Science Perspectives, a podcast brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. In this podcast, we'll be discussing emerging literature spanning the full spectrum of SCI research, from discovery to clinical application. You're listening to a Community Perspectives episode with Dr. Stephen Burns. I'm David.
And I'm Marla. And today we will be discussing the paper titled Development and Validation of an Algorithm for Item Reduction of the International Standards for Neurological Classification of Spinal Cord Injury Examination to Determine Level and Severity of SCI, which was recently accepted for publication in Topics in Spinal Cord Injury Rehabilitation. This paper was submitted to us by Asia's International Standards Committee. Our guest today is Dr. Stephen Burns. Stephen Burns is a physiatrist who serves as the director of SCI service at the VA Puget Sound and is a professor in the Department of Rehabilitation Medicine at the University of Washington School of Medicine in Seattle. He is a member and past chair of Asia's International Standards Committee, and he participated in the development of SCI patient registry currently used by the U.S. Department of Veterans Affairs. Welcome, Dr. Burns.
Thank you very much.
Could you start off by explaining to us kind of the difference between the regular or the what we quote full INSCI, or sometimes people call it the Asia exam, and this expedited version that we're talking about today in this paper?
Sure. So most people with spinal cord injuries have undergone an examination of their muscle strength and sensation on their skin, probably recall somebody holding a worksheet, maybe with a picture of a striped person on it and being poked with a pin and sharp and dull and that sort of thing. That is the INSCI or the Asia exam that's been in use for about 40 years. We do that so that we can assess how much strength and how much sensation is preserved. And then we apply classifications to that to be a summary of what's working and what's not. And that's important because the muscles that are working determine what someone can and cannot do, or what assistive devices they'll need. And the early exam can be predictive of how much strength and sensation is going to come back. And it's something that we use as a measure in research studies. So this INSCI, it involves testing a lot of things, 10 muscles on either side of the body, and on the skin, 28 spots where we need to test. So the full exam is enormous.
Thanks, Dr. Burns. And I hear words thrown around a lot. I'm a C6. I'm a T whatever. So there are ways I've seen the community communicating some of the information from the INSCI. Can you tell us like the key information that clinicians, providers get from the INSCI, and maybe introduce us to some of those acronyms?
Sure. So when we go through this process and examine all of those things, all the spots on the skin and on the muscles, there are different ways that we can classify it. One of them is what you were just referring to as a level. And this is the precise definition is the lowest level down, where if we went even one level lower with the wiring of the spinal cord, we would start to get into abnormality. So the beginning of the part of the spinal cord that's affected is what we get the next one down. So the level is the lowest level with normal sensation and motor, with everything above it being normal. And this is our precise term for this is the NLI, the neurological level of injury. The other basic measurement is the severity or the completeness of the injury. And this is measured with the Asia Impairment Scale, that's sometimes abbreviated AIS, sometimes incorrectly abbreviated as Asia Score, but the ABCD that that you may have seen or heard someone mentioning, that's a measure of the severity. And A is a complete loss of sensory and motor below the injury level. A B means the motor is lost, but there's some sensation preserved. And then with the C's and the D's, there are different amounts of motor that are preserved. And it turns out that those classifications, there are others, but those two are the ones that we focused this shortest exam, the ENSCE version 2, on determining those ones. So the level of injury and the severity of the injury.
Fantastic. And one more background question before we got on to the great updates you all did. Is there any information from this exam that clinicians or professionals might want that I might not care that much about if I have my spinal cord injury? So maybe I'm communicating that I'm a C5 incomplete, but you want a little bit more information out of the exam.
So there are more precise classifications that can go on it. There's something called a zone of partial preservation for kind of how far down below the injury level is something preserved, and we can define sensory levels and motor levels on the right side and the left side. We can sum up the scores that we're recording for each of the sensory spots. So there's sort of another level of classifications there that we can get if we do the full exam. But the basic ones give us a good starting point. And often that's precise enough if I'm communicating with my staff, if they have to get planning on a wheelchair being ready for somebody that's being admitted the next day, knowing, yep, he's a C6, complete injury, okay. We know what we want to probably set up for this person to be ready to go. Very, very fast way to communicate this 134 things that we're examining.
Yeah, and we definitely want to encourage the community. Physical medicine and rehabilitation physician training is 4 years, and then you're talking about another year of spinal cord injury fellowship. So you're talking 5 years of training, and then when you're talking with Dr. Burns here, not to call you out here, Dr. Burns, but we'll just say many years of working as a clinician as well. So please ask questions, clarification. There's, that's what your doctor is there, is to answer questions, to make sure you have an understanding, and also why we want everybody to be following up after they, initially leave the hospital, because there's a lot that goes into this. So just make sure you're asking your doc. And then also want to refer listeners back to one of our first episodes, episode 3, which we recorded all the way back in February 2022, where we talked with Dr. Kirschblum about some of the more intricacies of the ENSCE exam. So definitely check that out if you have some more questions. So just getting back to this paper, Dr. Burns, could you talk, this paper is focused on what we're calling the expedited ENSCE exam. Could you talk a little bit about the differences and, what potential benefits or drawbacks there might be to the person that's having the exam performed on them of the expedited version versus the full version?
Sure. So the expedited version eliminates a lot of the testing, a lot of the sensory testing. But it does include all of the muscle testing, which is what the clinicians find the most useful. And like I said earlier, it's a lot of what is determining what somebody's function is going to be and what things they'll need assistance for or assistive devices. So the big difference with the expedited exam is that it takes a lot less time to do it. It's only including about 30% of the items that we would test if we tested did the full exam. So what that means to patients, if you were getting this exam at a follow-up appointment a year or two after injury, if the doctor had to do an exam for classification, they could maybe get it done 10 or 15 minutes faster, and that time could be used to address another issue rather than the entire appointment was taken up doing this exam with 134 things. The trade-off is that it's not going to be 100% accurate, and we're not going to examine all of the sensory things, but what we found in the research we did was that on the 100 cases we checked, it got the correct severity of injury, the correct AIS, 100% of the time, and it got the correct level, the neurologic level of injury, 98% of the time. So the committee was quite happy that it's that accurate. So if those are the classifications that the clinical team needs, and that combined with the fact that they're testing all of the muscles, all of our standard muscles, the five upper limb and five lower limb muscles, then huge time savings, gets the information that we need. So for many situations, but not all, this would be a good time savings option. So that time could be spent on something more important to the patient and more important to the clinician.
Dr. Burns, if you're saving this time and getting a pretty darn accurate reading, would a doctor ever choose to do the full exam?
Sure, the full exam is recommended at certain time points. Early after injury, we want to assess everything, come up with all the classifications, make sure there's not another condition that's going on. So that's going to be the most accurate way to do it. We also recommend when someone is first admitted to inpatient rehabilitation that everything is checked. That's a good time point to see exactly what are we working with and figure out what the functional goals should be. If for some reason the other classifications besides the level of injury and the severity are needed, very much so if someone is having symptoms where they feel like they're losing strength or losing sensation or losing function, it would be best to do a full exam in those situations and compare to a previous full exam. But for other situations, the shortened exam is probably appropriate. In the end, the clinician may be choosing to do something different than that, and based on how specific the symptoms are that someone has. So it's never going to be the case that one exam is always the appropriate one. We expect that the clinicians are going to be aware of this option. They certainly like to save time or use time appropriately. And so we do think that a large number of the exams that'll be done will be this shortened one. And it can be a huge shortening. I used this recently with one of my residents on a couple of follow-up exams on patients on our unit. And we only had to test two spots on the skin in those patients to be done. They were sort of unusual situations, but we had two patients where this came up. So it wasn't checking 28 spots on each side of the body for this and that. We did two. We actually did two extra ones just to be safe, just to make sure we've covered things. And that is, according to the instructions, enough. And the classification we got fits with what the full exam had showed previously. So this could be a very big reduction. So don't necessarily think your doctor's taking some crazy shortcut or whatever. It can be that much of a savings, and then moving on to some other aspect or paying more attention, carefully looking at the motor exam, which we all know is the most important part.
Wow, that's a great point you make there. And you make such a compelling argument for that time savings that hopefully is used to just access more, either clinical time with the doctor or services. And you say you get there by going from this 134 items, if we're doing all the sensory, that's the poking and the brushing on the skin and the motor, and then you reduce that number. But there is a number in the categories for the exam. And one of the categories only has two components, and yet it's two components that a lot of us think a lot about. So I remember, this exam is being done the first time I'm observing it, and the last two components that were done were involved in this concept of sacral sparing. And it seems like the professionals are so focused on the sacral sparing. And yet, from certain people's standpoint, it's like, well, if I can't wiggle my toe, like, why do you guys care so much about this sacral sparing? And so, Dr. Burns, can you maybe introduce our audience to why, as professionals, we care so much about this sacral sparing?
Sure. So the sacral sparing is what we use to decide if the injury is a complete injury or an incomplete one. And we check that in a couple of ways. We check the sensation at the lowest testable spot on the skin. So it's the dermatome, the spot on the skin that's labeled as the S4, S5 nerve roots go to it. And this is very close to the anus. And then the other thing that we check is we do a digital rectal exam, so putting a finger into the rectum to see if the patient has sensation and if they're able to squeeze the contract a voluntary anal contraction. And those are the determinants. If none of that is present, then the patient has a complete injury. No signals are making it to the lowest testable portion. With the Folensky exam, the anorectal exam has to be performed. It's one of the 134 things that's in there. With the Ensky, for some patients, the rectal exam can be omitted. Because in some patients, there's enough information from the rest of the exam that we don't need those results. We know that the person has an incomplete injury or a motor incomplete injury, and we could pretty much ignore those results. So the Ensky allows it to be skipped in those cases. But if what the rectal exam shows could affect the classification, then the rectal exam has to be performed. So this is not the clinician's favorite part of the exam. It is a hassle to do this. We know that it can be uncomfortable for some patients. It can be messy. It's a sensitive area of the body, privacy, a bunch of reasons. We would like it if we had a good option to come up with an accurate classification that didn't require that, but for some patients, that will still be required. And for all patients with this version that we've just published on, there's some testing at that S4-5 dermatome, so the skin very close to the anus. We need to check to see if there's any sensation there. If we find any sensation there, we know that it's an incomplete injury.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dr. Burns. For the listeners here, using the updated V2 algorithm that these scientists did, they applied that to a pre-existing data set. 100 people randomly pulled out that data set. And in that case, 44% of them did not require this sacral sparing testing that the good doctor is talking about. So that's about a 50% chance, if you'll allow me to round up. Where that wasn't required based on this expedited version 2 update, which is great. But not to keep pulling on this thread, Dr. Burns, but I think it's a really unique opportunity to communicate why this use of sacral sparing is for complete and incomplete, because you might hear someone say, well, if I can't move my toes and I can't feel my feet, isn't that complete?
Yeah, the way that injuries occur, if the sensation is going to be preserved anywhere below the injury, it tends to be the sacral segments. And we have many examples of patients we've seen where the only place that they can feel anything below their injury level is right at the anus, either when we do a rectal exam or just the skin outside of that. I've had patients come in where that's the only area of the body that they're feeling something, and they ended up having a lot of strength recovery and further sensation re recovery. So patients that are incomplete initially for sensation, it's variable how much is going to come back. So we want to be recognizing if there are any signals that are passing through, and the best place to check for it, if it's going to be preserved anywhere, it's at that spot. So that's why one of the reasons why the definition for complete versus incomplete is using the sensation in that area.
Yeah, thanks so much, Dr. Burns. In the paper, you guys bring up the case of a acute, so recent injury, and it gets classified in that AIS as a B, and the difference in what you would expect for recovery there and what you can communicate to the person in terms of what we call medically their prognosis. So I thought that example was very astute. And then just for the listeners, really quick, as you go down the cord, nerves coming out, it seems like the ones at the bottom of the cord would go to the feet. but it's actually at the very bottom of the chord. That's what goes to the sacral area. So for complete or incomplete, that's why sometimes these exams are required. All right. Thank you so much for that clarification there.
Dr. Burns, one of the kind of unique parts of this paper versus some of the other ones that we've discussed on the podcast is that this paper is really helping to develop like a protocol that physicians throughout the country are going to be using and really throughout the world are going to be using, and that, you know, kind of collaborates work across the field. Versus, you know, some of the papers that we talk about, which is like, you know, new research or new things. This is something that all clinicians are, you know, hopefully going to be utilizing. Can you talk a little bit about just the use of an expert panel, how protocols like this are developed, what goes into, you know, the background research to make sure that, you know, you mentioned the 98 to 100% accuracy. You know, how is that developed, and how can people that are undergoing these exams be confident that the results of the exam are accurate?
Okay, so this protocol and all of the classification rules for the INSCI are developed by a committee of the American Spinal Injury Association, the International Standards Committee. The Asia, as an organization, started developing standardized instructions for how we examine someone and how we classify in the 1980s, and got international endorsement around 1990. So that's when we began calling it the international standards. Called it that, and you know, sure enough, that's what it, you know, rapidly became. And there's really worldwide acceptance that this is the best way to be doing it. It gets changed every 4 or 5 years with some clarifications, a few additions, but the process is a group of experts, clinicians and researchers, not just physicians, with physical therapists included. Even though it's Asia's committee, we have representation from outside of America, a number of members from Europe, and the fact that we, you know, we included the analyses we did was with a large Canadian database of exams, as well as a multi-nation European database as well. That helps to ensure that the results reflect all people with spinal cord injuries, and not just a trend in a, you know, single area of the world or type of care that's coming in through a specific system of care. You know, in the past, 40 years ago, this committee would just put out the standards, and that's what it was. But the current approach is that we want research to back up what the committees are coming up with. So the research paper that was published is the analysis of these cases, the 7,000 plus cases from Canada, and then 100, and then another 100 cases from the European database that we went through and classified just step by step, how many steps would it take and how accurate things were. So it's not just a, you know, committee arguing and coming to consensus, but we also are publishing the data in journals where it has to be reviewed by experts who are uninvolved, who agree that yes, this, you know, this is correct, and this is a correct interpretation of the numbers. So that's really the strategy now, and we're fortunate that we have these databases that include thousands of exams from people with spinal cord injuries at different time points after their injury to model things, to see what if we, for this study, what if we classify this way, would we be accurate or not? So that's the approach. It's people that are recognized who are experts on the committee. We do research, and then we make decisions on how to modify how this is being done.
That's great, Dr. Burns. So you've convinced me. 30% of the items I can save the time, especially if I have an incomplete entry. Maybe I can skip parts of the test I don't like. And a bunch of really smart people used a democratic process to validate this thing. So I'm ready to have the eInsky version 2 done on me. I go to my provider and they haven't heard of this. Where can I tell them to go to learn how to use this exam?
So the best place to go is the Asia website, or they could just Google Asia eInsky. They can get all the letters in that long abbreviation. But it's freely available on the Asia website. The version 2 has been posted since the beginning of June 2025. And if we when we actually when we make updates, because I'm sure we'll modify the wording and some clarifications, the current version will always be there and will always be freely available, because if this is the world standard, the international standard, it has to be available to everyone and freely available to use. So that's the go-to spot. There are already some training resources up there for clinicians who want to learn doing it this new way.
Thanks so much, Dr. Burns, for being here. And if anyone's interested in learning more about the eInsky, and it's particularly the version 2, we're going to link in the show notes to Asia's website so you can learn more about it there. And really appreciate you being here, Dr. Burns. Thanks again.
Absolutely, my pleasure. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening to this episode of SCI Science Perspectives, brought to you by the American Spinal Injury Association. The paper discussed in this episode was chosen based on the recommendation of Asia's International Standards Committee. The podcast was created under the leadership of Dr. Suzanne Groh and is sustained by your producer hosts, David McMillan, Marla Petrillo, Maria Kallik, Trevor Dyson Hudson, and our editor, Abby Fox, and Asia's front office. If you have any comments, questions, or concerns, please contact us at SEIPerspectivesPodcast@gmail.com.